Eric Kolvig, November 4th, 2004.
So let's start by introducing ourselves to each other. We can start anywhere and go anywhere. I'm Eric.
John.
Mel.
Sandy.
Ken.
And anyone who's just come in, if you could just shout out your name.
Debbie. And what else am I supposed to say?
That's all.
John.
Bonnie. I brought my
wings. Oh,
great. Good. Welcome. Okay. I am really glad to be here with you tonight. In this, what for me has been a difficult week, it's just I take refuge in you as my sangha, my community. And I'm glad that we're gathering this evening. I've got it on. Here? No? Yes? Okay. I'm glad we're gathered here this evening. The subject of the talk tonight is taking refuge after the election. And I'm only going to make one partisan political comment this evening. And then after that, I promise there will be no others. And I apologize in advance if this comment offends anyone. But a few days ago, I got a phone message from Mary Roy, whom many of us know, who a member of this community who has moved to Seattle. And she's very well, and she's just going off to attend a six-week-long meditation retreat at Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. So this afternoon, I left her a phone message in return, just giving her support, and I ended the phone message with a very standard kind of Buddhist blessing for anyone who's about to go into practice, and then something else slipped out. So I said, get free and save all beings, and save the Republicans especially. So that's my only partisan comment for tonight. Tuesday, on Election Day, it's the most recent edition of High Country News arrived in my mailbox. And it was just one of those wonderful moments when the right words arrived at the right time. In this current edition of High Country News, there's a brief review of a book with a great name, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. And with this comes a quotation that's contained in the book from Parker Palmer. And he says, sometimes we get a deeper look into the world's heart and our own when we stand not on the shifting sands of society and ego, but on the bedrock realities of the natural and spiritual world. And so what I'd like to talk about tonight is to talk a little bit about the bedrock realities that we can stand on, the spiritual realities that come from this spiritual tradition, from the teachings and practice of the Buddha. I think it can be very useful in a challenging time to know that there are principles that are universal. They're universal, they're universally true in all times and places. And as I look back over what little I know about the history of Buddhism, over a period of nearly 2,600 years now, I see the way in which these principles have sustained people through very great difficulty. They're sustaining the Tibetan people today through centuries and centuries of warfare and pestilence and famine and civil wars and terrible oppression from governments. And so it's just very... Please, come on in. We have some chairs. Can we get... are there any more chairs back there? Are there chairs just back this way? Thank you, Venerable Siva.
Very nice to see you, too.
This is a, you know, my first time to see you, many people. The thing is very nice.
Thank you. The Dharma is wonderfully sustaining, and so I think it's very useful for us to see if it's possible, having been, at least for myself, kind of on shifting sands recently, to find the bedrock of a reality. The first bedrock reality that I'd like to share from the teachings and the practice is what the Buddha called right effort. And simply stated, the Buddha said that right effort is to cultivate what is wholesome in our lives, what leads to happiness and leads to freedom, and to abandon what is unwholesome, what leads to suffering and leads to bondage. And I'd like to invite us to practice a little bit right effort right here this evening, by practicing what in this tradition is called the third foundation of mindfulness, that is bringing our attention and our awareness to what we call our emotional lives, what the Buddha called mind states or mental factors. It's very useful when you're practicing the third foundation of mindfulness, of being aware of our emotions. It's very useful. One particularly important step is to uncouple the emotion itself from the story that goes along with the emotion. So what tends to happen is our attention goes outward and we get caught up in some external event. Our attention gets caught up in some external event and we're not really aware of what's actually happening in our own minds and hearts. And this practice is about holding a mirror up to our minds and hearts. So, for example, just one little example. There's a story that I've been telling myself and I hear from a lot of other people about who will be nominating Supreme Court justices over the next 4 years. Very consequential. This is a consequential story. And yet it is still a story. So I don't want to demean it or dismiss it in any way. It's very important. But this particular practice is about letting go of that and being with what we're actually feeling. Does this make sense? So I'd like to just give one little example. Yesterday morning, I woke up feeling really discouraged and depressed. I felt it in my body. I felt a certain kind of mental pain right here in the heart center, and a kind of weight, and a kind of physical listlessness. And what I did was to stay with those feelings without telling a big story to myself about it. Just staying with those feelings of discouragement, of despair at times, of depression. And then by the end of the day, it had passed. Being willing to open to it, being willing to feel it, being willing not to cultivate it or feed it, and to let it pass when it passes. That's what the Buddha says when he says abandon what is unwholesome. Has anyone felt discouragement or depression or despair in the last 36 hours? So I imagine it's pretty common, huh? Do you see with the value of doing this? We could be practicing discouragement and despair for months and months and months if we keep telling ourselves a story. The Buddha says that unwholesome qualities of consciousness, like despair, never lead to happiness and they never lead to freedom. And so it's useful to let them go. Not to push them away or repress them, but just to let them go. So is there anyone who has felt fear in the last few months? It feels to me that to a large extent, fear is running the whole show globally right now. It's really very deep in our hearts here in this country. It's deep in the hearts of many, many other people in the world. It's a very destructive emotion because fear tends to lead to aggression. You know, either collapse or aggression. And so is it possible when we experience fear to feel it, to know it in our bodies, but not to feed it, not to cultivate it, not to practice it, but to let it pass when it passes? Is there anyone who has felt anger in the last few weeks? Or hatred? Is there anyone who has felt what the Buddha calls, it's a lousy translation into English, it's called conceit, that is comparing oneself to others as superior or inferior. And so, we, with our understanding of issues, are superior to them with their understanding of issues. Has anyone felt that? You know? It's really useful to see that. The Buddha said that conceit, this comparing mind, is a form of insanity. You know? To see it, to feel it, to know it, not to push it away, but to let it pass without feeding it. Because the kind of division that comes from that comparing mind does not help to heal anything. It's very useful to do this practice, to do this practice of the third foundation of mindfulness. This is one of the bedrock realities of our practice and of the teachings. And it's very liberating. And the other side of it is really to see what are the wholesome states of consciousness that we cultivate. The Buddha said, cultivate what is wholesome, abandon what is unwholesome. The practice of calm and patience and equanimity, concentration, energy, resolution, wisdom, compassion, love. See those when they arise. Feel them in your body. And know that they're worth supporting. They're worth cultivating, that they're liberating. That's also an aspect of doing this practice, the third foundation of mindfulness. If we don't pay attention, you know, if we're not vigilant, we could be doing quite a lot of cultivating of anger and hatred and fear and comparing mind and all the rest of it. And it can be dangerous. George Friedrich Nietzsche says, "Whoever battles monsters should take care not to become a monster too. For if you stare long enough into the abyss stares also into you." You know, has anyone been battling monsters in our minds and hearts? In the last few weeks, I sure have. The poet William Blake says, if we define ourselves in angry opposition, then we become what we behold. Is there another way? I'd like to just talk about a couple of particularly important wholesome traits that we can cultivate and how they might apply to our situation right now, historically. One is the quality of wisdom, of seeing what is true, of seeing things as they actually are. One aspect of wisdom is that the Buddha said that there are four kinds of attachment that perpetuate our suffering. He said there's attachment to sense pleasures, there's attachment to rites and rituals, there's attachment to the concept of self, and most important for the subject of the talk this evening, there's attachment to views and opinions. This perpetuates our suffering. It's important for us to have views and opinions. It's really important in a democracy for us to have views and opinions. It's important for us to act from our views and opinions with as much wisdom and compassion as we can have. But do you see the difference between doing that and being really attached? Of being rigidly dug into your views and opinions? No, to pay attention to that, to notice. Not to abandon views and opinions, but to see that we hold them lightly, even if we hold them with great strength. Another aspect of wisdom is from the mind that is filled with wisdom, that is replete with wisdom, there's a sense of the insubstantiality and the impermanence of existence. The Buddha said, beautiful statement in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, he said, "See all this passing world as a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, a shadow, a rainbow and a dream." Do you have some sense that of the dreamlike nature of our existence, being able to see its insubstantiality, its impermanence, to be able to see that we are in the dream, but we don't have to be of the dream, that we can act clearly and strongly, that if you have some sense of this, you know, the Buddha didn't say, "See all this passing world except the presidential election of 2004, you know, as a star at dawn, a bubble on the screen." And the teachings and another really wonderful bedrock reality that we can come to experience directly through our practice is to see that there is a reality which is not affected by changing events. There is a reality, and we are that reality, which isn't born and doesn't die. It's beautifully expressed, not so much in the Buddhist tradition, but in the Hindu tradition from the Bhagavad Gita. This is Krishna. "I say to you, weapons do not reach life. Flames do not burn it. Waters cannot overwhelm, nor dry winds wither it. Impenetrable, unentered, unassailed, unharmed, untouched, immortal, all arriving, stable, sure, invisible, ineffable, by word and thought uncompassed, ever all itself. Thus is the soul declared. We don't use the word soul in Buddhism, but this is a beautiful expression of that reality. If you haven't touched that reality yourself in your direct experience, it's really useful to do that. Because as we ground our understanding in that reality, it gives us a kind of strength in the midst of all the changes of our lives. When you know what dies and what doesn't, you can have a certain kind of confidence. When you know what is affected by things like elections and what isn't, it's really useful for us to remember that aspect of reality. And then there's the bedrock reality of love and compassion. So much of our activism on the social and political level can come from a sense of desperation, of fear, and of anger. And it's really possible to be more effective coming from a place of compassion and love. Yesterday I was talking to my landlord, who's an archaeologist, and we were consoling each other. And he said, "You know what I think I'm going to do? I think I'm going to give one day every week to doing something to help my community and to help the situation." And he said, "What I want to do is to look after the planet and to get into the face of anyone who's harming it." And he wasn't saying that out of a place of fierceness or anger. I know him. I know him pretty well. He's a compassionate guy. Do you see that there can be tremendous strength and tremendous resolve coming from a place of compassion? Compassion is seeing the suffering in the world and having the impulse to relieve that suffering. Some of you have heard me say these words before, but the Buddha said about anger, he said if anger is a motivating force, is a motivating force in our lives, he said, cannot sustain us. He said, anger is like a forest fire that burns up its own support. You see that? You know, we use the word burn out. And so, if we want to do something good for this world, you know, it's really useful to see exactly where the motivating force is. So, In the 1930s, there was a wonderful union organizer named Sam Hill who was framed for murder and went to trial and was executed. And as he was being led to his execution, he said, "Don't mourn, organize." I think those are good words for us. I would love to see us not mourning, but organizing. But not organizing out of anger or reactivity, but organizing out of a strong, fierce compassion. I just finished a really beautiful book on Lincoln and Whitman and their relationship and how they influenced each other during a really critical time in our history. And during the Civil War, Whitman wrote a poem that started with these words. And this is about the power of love. The Buddha said that love, real love, not the Hallmark stuff, but not sentimentality, But real love, the Buddha said, is the greatest healing power in the universe. It can heal us as individuals, and it can heal us as a society, and it can heal us as a global community. It can heal our environment. And here is, at the very most difficult and painful, and Whitman was right there. He spent hour after hour after hour really using himself up in the hospitals of Washington with dying soldiers, the sick and dying soldiers. He was right there in the midst of the horror. And this is what he wrote in the midst of that. Over the carnage rose prophetic a voice. Be not disheartened. Affection shall solve the problems of freedom yet. Those who love each other shall become invincible. They shall yet make Columbia victorious. So the power of love. You know, this is a choice that we can make in terms of turning with love in the situation that we face right now, historically. And I'd also like to, I'm going to step out of Buddhism a little bit here, and I better do it fairly quickly here. For me, there's a bedrock reality, for me personally, there's a bedrock reality in our social and political lives, and it's been very, very helpful for me to turn to that reality again and again, especially when I get discouraged. And it was actually articulated beautifully by Lincoln himself, who was a beautiful expression of that. These are words I'm sure you know. 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we would say all people are created equal, and some of us would say all beings are created equal. And then Lincoln went on to say, we are now engaged in the great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. So certain fundamental principles that have run throughout the history of this country, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to equality. Liberty, equality, justice, and I would add now the sanctity of our environment or the natural world. In the generation of Jefferson and Lincoln, they didn't have to worry about the actual destruction of the planet. But we have to hold that now ourselves. These principles have been betrayed over and over and over again throughout our history. And yet, they're still there. They're still important to us. And for me, they're a bedrock reality that I'd like to keep coming back to. And I find I've been a student of Abraham Lincoln my whole life. And I find it just really beautiful because this was someone, essentially what his role was for us, at a time, a very, very critical time, was that there were certain principles that were very important to him, that were articulated there. The principle of liberty and the principle of equality. And justice. And he was the most eloquent person of the 19th century in terms of articulating these principles. And he held steadfast to them. And carried us through where another leader who might have wobbled, there would have been a different outcome. And actually, Lincoln's presidency was a totally failed presidency up until about a month and a half or 2 months before the 1864 election. And then it became a very successful presidency. But through that time of darkness and challenge and failure, he didn't wobble. And so, for me, it's very important to keep coming back to these principles and to realize, yes, just from my perspective, these principles have been especially challenged 3 times in our past. They were challenged during the decades of the formation of this country from the 1770s to the first decade of the 19th century. They were very challenged in the middle of the 19th century in the lead up to and the Civil War and the aftermath of the Civil War. They were challenged again in the time of the Great Depression, and I think this is the fourth. They're very challenged now. That because of fear, because of the immense corrosive power of fear, which the Buddha described as a kalesa, that is, as one of the root tormentors of our minds and hearts, because of the corrosive power of fear, these principles are being compromised. And for me, it's really useful personally to keep coming back to them. Whitman says in Song of Myself, he says, these are the days that must happen to you. So these are the days that must happen to us. You know, that, and I think it's critically important, actually. It's critically important for us as individuals, for us as a local community here, but I think it's important for us as a national community and as a global community to be really clear about where we're coming from, what principles we stand by. We have spiritual principles in our spiritual tradition. But for me, also, there are political and social principles. To be very clear about what the motivations are in our hearts. Otherwise, we get lost. And getting lost can be very, very consequential at this time. So I'd like to just end with a guided loving kindness meditation, if that's okay. So actually, let's start with compassion. If you would, just think of the discomfort that you have experienced starting, say, September 11th, 2001. You know, the emotional discomfort. What you personally have gone through in our public life, in our social and political life. And then think what we as a nation have gone through in those 38, 39 months. And then think of what the world has gone through. Think of the level of suffering. The level of suffering that comes from people who are identified with fear, and out of their fear, they act with aggression. The Buddha said, hatred cannot cease by hatred. Hatred can only cease by love. And then if you would, if you're willing to do so, extend compassion to yourself for the suffering that you've experienced since September 11th, 2001. Just saying to yourself, may I be free from suffering. May this suffering dissolve. May I be free from suffering. And then if you would, just sensing the suffering that we have gone through as a nation, and the suffering that we face now, and just extending the same compassion, may we all be free from suffering. And then if you would, extending your heart, and seeing how this suffering has spread globally, just having some sense there have been two big wars since September 11th, 2001, and neither is over. Just may all who have ever been touched by this suffering be free from suffering. May we be free from suffering. Cultivating the transformative power of compassion. And then if you would, extending loving kindness, see if it's possible to extend loving kindness toward all of us who have been affected by this recent election. See if it's possible to extend loving kindness without any discrimination, without any choice, sending it to the Greens and to the Constitution Party folks and to the Independents, the Nader folks, to the Republicans and to the Democrats. May we all be happy. May we all be safe and protected from all danger and harm. May we be free from fear and the effects of fear. May we be healthy in our minds and our bodies. May we live with ease and well-being. And may we be liberated. And then if you would, extending the same loving kindness towards everyone on this planet who has been affected by September 11th, what happened on September 11th, 2001, and its aftermath. And also who have been affected by whatever caused people to do what they did on September 11th, 2001. It didn't happen out of a vacuum. Without discrimination toward everyone involved, toward those who have committed terrible violence and toward those who have experienced terrible violence, toward those who have stood by passively and done nothing, toward all of us, everyone on this planet affected by this situation, may we be happy. May we be safe and protected from all danger and harm. May we be free from fear and the effects of fear. May we be healthy in our bodies and our minds. May we live with ease and well-being. May we all be free. On every level of freedom, the liberty that Jefferson wrote about, including the Bill of Rights, that level of liberty, but also going all the way to the level of full enlightenment, of complete liberation of our minds and hearts. May we all be free. Thank you. So, in terms of time, what do we have time for a discussion, or should we?
Yeah.
Is there any comments or questions or just consequential subjects? Yes.
Just in case anybody has to leave, we'd like to have you stay in the class. I'm thinking you'll have to leave. First of all, I'd just like to say welcome to join together again. And you acknowledge me. Great gratitude, the physical presence of the most, you know, city and its walk and its renovation. And all the things here in this room together and the person that we've come together is truly impressive. And to have you here is also very wonderful. And so I'd like to give just a short on top. This is gratitude in my heart. I hope that you're also feeling the expression of Donna is can be made to the donation to both the Sangha and to our teacher Eric here tonight.
Actually, I'm not a teacher tonight. I'm just a Sangha member, so I'm not taking donations. Thank you. This is